Penguin Random House Audio presents Ruth Bader Ginsburg, A Life, by Jane Sharon DeHart. Read for you by Suzanne Torin. 4. Jerry, for unwavering love and support. Preface. An American Icon. The year was 1993. The President of the United States strode toward the lectern in the White House Rose Garden, accompanied by a diminutive 60-year-old woman in a cobalt blue suit and dark sunglasses. Before a bipartisan sprinkling of the Senate Judiciary Committee, family members, friends, and the national press, Bill Clinton presented his replacement for the retiring Justice Byron White, Judge Ruth Bader Ginsburg. In the months and years ahead, he predicted, the nation would come to know much more about the woman at his side. "People will find, as I have," he pledged, "that this nominee is a person of immense character. Quite simply, what's in her record speaks volumes about what is in her heart. She has stood for the individual, the person less well off, the outsider in society, and has given them greater hope by telling them that they have a place in our legal system." "Indeed," Clinton continued, "many admirers of her work say she is to the women's movement what former Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall was to the movement for African Americans." Following the president to the lectern, the nominee responded graciously, thanking him, and especially New York's Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who first brought her to Clinton's attention. She followed the introduction of her family with a statement that was at once personal and political. "The announcement the president made is significant, I believe, because it contributes to the end of the days when women, at least half the talent pool in our society, appear in high places only as one-at-a-time performers." Noting that Justice Sandra Day O'Connor was sitting on the Supreme Court, and nearly 25 women served on the U.S. Court of Appeals, two as chief judges, she predicted that more would follow. She then recalled her daughter's 1973 high school yearbook, where her firstborn, Jane, had listed under ambition her hope to see her mother nominated to the Supreme Court. The next line read, "If necessary, Jane will appoint her." "Jane is so pleased, Mr. President, that you did it instead. And her brother James is, too." Then Ginsburg turned to the many to whom she felt indebted. A revived women's movement and the civil rights movement of the 1960s, from which feminists in the United States had drawn inspiration, as well as colleagues and family. And with a deft touch, she mentioned that this was not the first time that a member of her family had stood next to Hillary Rodham Clinton, whom she herself had met just that day. "There is another I love dearly, with whom the First Lady is already an old friend." Holding up a photograph of Mrs. Clinton surrounded by nursery school children singing the toothbrush song, she pointed to "my wonderful granddaughter, Clara." She also thanked her husband, Marty, "my best friend and biggest booster," her mother-in-law, Evelyn, "the most supportive parent a person could have," and children with "tastes to appreciate that Daddy cooks ever so much better than Mommy, and so phased me out of the kitchen at a relatively early age." She concluded with a tribute to her mother, Celia Amster Bader, "the bravest and strongest person I have ever known. I pray that I may be all that she would have been had she lived in an age when women could aspire and achieve, and daughters are as much cherished as sons." Those final words left the president fighting back tears. As I watched the ceremony on the evening news, it never occurred to me that 5 years later, I might actually meet the justice, much less write about her. My work as a historian had taken a new turn when I began exploring the dual constitutional strategy that had been devised by feminist lawyers in the late 1960s to secure gender equality in the law. One prong of that strategy sought ratification of an Equal Rights Amendment, ERA, to the Constitution, prohibiting gender-based discrimination. The other called for litigation efforts to persuade the Supreme Court to strike down laws that discriminated on the basis of gender. Ginsburg, then a law professor at Rutgers and later at Columbia University, spearheaded the latter effort in the 1970s under the auspices of the Women's Rights Project of the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU. Having lately completed a fine-grained analysis of efforts in a key southern state that twice came 2 votes short of ratifying the amendment, I turned to another project. Midway into that exercise, I began research for a chapter in which I hoped to make use of Ginsburg's women's rights litigation as an example of judicial policymaking. Heading to the Seeley Mudd Library at Princeton University, where the archives for the ACLU are deposited, I wanted to understand how, in less than a decade, a law professor known primarily for her expertise in civil procedure and comparative law, someone who prior to 1973 had never argued a case before the Supreme Court, became the nation's foremost litigator for gender equality. Being in the right place at the right time, Ginsburg's characteristically modest explanation tells part of the story, but it does not explain how she acquired the capacious vision of equality that she brought to her litigation, her strategic sensibility, or her passion for justice. I found just one case file containing correspondence between the ACLU's legal director, Melvin Wolf, and Kiki Ginsburg, who had volunteered to write the brief for a test case known as Reed v. Reed. Her brief won the case, convincing the justices for the first time in the nation's history that gender-based discrimination violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. Eager to see files for her cases following Reed, I asked for the records of the Women's Rights Project. They were not at the Seeley Mudd Library, I was told. They must still be in New York at the ACLU's national office. Regrettably, they were not. Indeed, nobody seemed to know where they were. When I finally appealed to Justice Ginsburg to help track down the records, she discovered that they had been lost in a move of the ACLU's headquarters. Offering to make her own files available, she had the material transported to the manuscript division of the Library of Congress the day before I arrived in Washington in October 1998. Hours of poring over letters, memos, drafts of briefs, and outlines for oral arguments left me enthralled. The issues Ginsburg addressed resonated personally and intellectually. The strategic sense, craft, and precision that went into her brief writing dazzled. And the relationship that emerged with one of her clients and his small son demonstrated a level of caring that was unmistakable. On my third day, during my lunch break, I phoned Mava Marcus, then the Supreme Court historian, to thank her for her role in transmitting my initial inquiry about the missing papers to Justice Ginsburg. She immediately invited me to a meeting of the Supreme Court Historical Society that was scheduled for that same evening. The distinguished historian John Hope Franklin would be speaking, and if the Ginsburgs attended, I could express my appreciation to the justice in person. Spotting the couple at the front of the auditorium as the lecture ended, I offered a quick thank you before backing off so her conversation with Justice Souter could continue. During the reception that followed, we had 2 further brief encounters, each initiated by the justice. As we talked about one particular case.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?